of the independent Arabs, who were divided by interest or affection in the long quarrel of the East. The tribe of Ghassan was allowed to encamp on the Syrian territory. The princes of Hira were permitted to form a city about 40 miles to the southward of the ruins of Babylon. Their service in the field was speedy and vigorous, but their friendship was venal, their faith inconstant, their enmity capricious. It was an easier task to excite than to disarm these roving barbarians, and in the familiar intercourse of war, they learned to see and to despise the splendid weakness both of Rome and of Persia. From Mecca to the Euphrates, the Arabian tribes were confounded by the Greeks and Latins under the general appellation of Saracens, a name which every Christian mouth has been taught to pronounce with terror and abhorrence. The slaves of domestic tyranny may vainly exult in their national independence, but the Arab is personally free, and he enjoys in some degree the benefits of society without forfeiting the prerogatives of nature. In every tribe, superstition or gratitude or fortune has exalted a particular family above the heads of their equals. The dignities of sheikh and emir invariably descend in this chosen race. But the order of succession is loose and precarious, and the most worthy or aged of the noble kinsmen are preferred to the simple though important office of composing disputes by their advice and guiding valor by their example. Even a female of sense and spirit has been permitted to command the countrymen of Zenobia. The momentary junction of several tribes produces an army. Their more lasting union constitutes a nation. And the supreme chief, the emir of emirs, whose banner is displayed at their head, may deserve in the eyes of strangers the honors of the kingly name. If the Arabian princes abuse their power, they are quickly punished by the desertion of their subjects, who had been accustomed to a mild and parental jurisdiction. Their spirit is free, their steps are unconfined, the desert is open, and the tribes and families are held together by a mutual and voluntary compact. The softer natives of Yemen supported the pomp and majesty of a monarch, but if he could not leave his palace without endangering his life, the active powers of government must have been devolved on his nobles and magistrates. The cities of Mecca and Medina present, in the heart of Asia, the form, or rather the substance, of a commonwealth. The grandfather of Muhammad and his lineal ancestors appear in foreign and domestic transactions as the princes of their country. But they reigned, like Pericles at Athens or the Medici at Florence, by the opinion of their wisdom and integrity. Their influence was divided with the patrimony, and the scepter was transferred from the uncles of the prophet to a younger branch of the tribe of Quraysh. On solemn occasions they convened the assembly of the people, and since mankind must be either compelled or persuaded to obey, the use and reputation of oratory among the ancient Arabs is the clearest evidence of public freedom. But their simple freedom was of a very different cast from the nice and artificial machinery of the Greek and Roman republics, in which each member possessed an undivided share of the civil and political rights of the community. In the more simple state of the Arabs, the nation is free because each of her sons disdains a base submission to the will of a master. His breast is fortified by the austere virtues of courage, patience, and sobriety. The love of independence prompts him to exercise the habits of self-command, and the fear of dishonor guards him from the meaner apprehension of pain, of danger, and of death. The gravity and firmness of the mind is conspicuous in his outward demeanor. His speech is low, weighty, and concise. He is seldom provoked to laughter. His only gesture is that of stroking his beard, the venerable symbol of manhood, and the sense of his own importance teaches him to accost his equals without levity, and his superiors without awe. The liberty of the Saracens survived their conquests. The first caliphs indulged the bold and familiar language of their subjects. They ascended the pulpit to persuade and edify the congregation. Nor was it before the seat of empire was removed to the Tigris that the Abbasides adopted the proud and pompous ceremonial of the Persian and Byzantine courts. In the study of nations and men, we may observe the causes that render them hostile or friendly to each other, that tend to narrow or enlarge, to mollify or exasperate the social character. The separation of the Arabs from the rest of mankind has accustomed them to confound the ideas of stranger and enemy, and the poverty of the land has introduced a maxim of jurisprudence which they believe and practice to the present hour. They pretend that in the division of the earth, the rich and fertile climates were assigned to the other branches of the human family, and that the posterity of the outlaw Ismail might recover, by fraud or force, the portion of inheritance of which he had been unjustly deprived. According to the remark of Pliny, the Arabian tribes are equally addicted to theft and merchandise. The caravans that traverse the desert are ransomed or pillaged, and their neighbors, since the remote times of Job and Sesostris, have been the victims of their rapacious spirit. If a Bedouin discovers from afar a solitary traveler, he rides furiously against him, crying with a loud voice, "Undress thyself, thy aunt, my wife, is without a garment." A ready submission entitles him to mercy. Resistance will provoke the aggressor, and his own blood must expiate the blood which he presumes to shed in legitimate defense. A single robber, or a few associates, are branded with their genuine name, but the exploits of a numerous band assume the character of lawful and honorable war. The temper of a people thus armed against mankind was doubly inflamed by the domestic license of rapine, murder, and revenge. In the constitution of Europe, the right of peace and war is now confined to a small, and the actual exercise to a much smaller list of respectable potentates. But each Arab, with impunity and renown, might point his javelin against the life of his countrymen. The union of the nation consisted only in a vague resemblance of language and manners, and in each community the jurisdiction of the magistrate was mute and impotent. Of the time of ignorance which preceded Muhammad, 1700 battles are recorded by tradition. Hostility was embittered with the rancor of civil faction, and the recital, in prose or verse, of an obsolete feud was sufficient to rekindle the same passions among the descendants of the hostile tribes. In private life, every man, at least every family, was the judge and avenger of his own cause. The nice sensibility of honor, which weighs the insult rather than the injury, sheds its deadly venom on the quarrels of the Arabs. The honor of their women and of their beards is most easily wounded. An indecent action, a contemptuous word, can be expiated only by the blood of the offender, and such is their patient inveteracy that they expect whole months and years the opportunity of revenge. A fine or compensation for murder is familiar to the barbarians of every age. But in Arabia, the kinsmen of the dead are at liberty to accept the atonement, or to exercise, with their own hands, the law of retaliation. The refined malice of the Arabs refuses even the head of the murderer, substitutes an innocent for the guilty person, and transfers the penalty to the best and most considerable of the race by whom they have been injured. If he falls by their hands, they are exposed in their turn to the danger of reprisals. The interest and principal of the bloody debt are accumulated. The individuals of either family lead a life of malice and suspicion, and 50 years may sometimes elapse before the account of vengeance be finally settled. The sanguinary spirit, ignorant of pity or forgiveness, has been moderated, however, by the maxims of honour, which require in every private encounter some decent equality of age and strength, of numbers and weapons. An annual festival of 2, perhaps of 4 months, was observed by the Arabs before the time of Muhammad, during which their swords were religiously sheathed, both in foreign and domestic hostility. And this partial truce is more strongly expressive of the habits of anarchy and warfare. But the spirit of rapine and revenge was attempered by the milder influence of trade and literature. The solitary peninsula is encompassed by the most civilized nations of the ancient world. The merchant is the friend of mankind, and the annual caravans imported the first seeds of knowledge and politeness into the cities and even the camps of the desert. Whatever may be the pedigree of the Arabs, their language is derived from the same original stock with the Hebrew, the Syriac, and the Chaldean tongues. The independence of the tribes was marked by their peculiar dialects, but each, after their own, allowed a just preference to the pure and perspicuous idiom of Mecca. In Arabia, as well as in Greece, the perfection of language outstripped the refinement of manners, and her speech could diversify the 80 names of honey, the 200 of a serpent, the 500 of a lion, the 1,000 of a sword, at a time when this copious dictionary was entrusted to the memory of an illiterate people. The monuments of the Homerites were inscribed with an obsolete and mysterious character, but the Cufic letters, the groundwork of the present alphabet, were invented on the banks of the Euphrates, and the recent invention was taught at Mecca by a stranger who settled in that city after the birth of Muhammad. The arts of grammar, of meter, and of rhetoric were unknown to the free-born eloquence of the Arabians, but their penetration was sharp, their fancy luxuriant, their wit strong and sententious, and their more elaborate compositions were addressed with energy and effect to the minds of their hearers. The genius and merit of a rising poet was celebrated by the applause of his own and the kindred tribes. A solemn banquet was prepared, and a chorus of women, striking their timbrels and displaying the pomp of their nuptials, sung in the presence of their sons and husbands the felicity of their native tribe. That a champion had now appeared to vindicate their rights, that a herald had raised his voice to immortalize their renown. The distant or hostile tribes resorted to an annual fair, which was abolished by the fanaticism of the first Muslims, a national assembly that must have contributed to refine and harmonize the barbarians. 30 days were employed in the exchange not only of corn and wine, but of eloquence and poetry. The prize was disputed by the generous emulation of the bards. The victorious performance was deposited in the archives of princes and emirs, and we may read in our own language the 7 original poems which were inscribed in letters of gold and suspended in the temple of Mecca. The Arabian poets were the historians and moralists of the age, and if they sympathized with the prejudices, they inspired and crowned the virtues of their countrymen. The indissoluble union of generosity and valor was the darling theme of their song, and when they pointed their keenest satire against a despicable race, they affirmed, in the bitterness of reproach, that the men knew not how to give, nor the women to deny. The same hospitality which was practiced by Abraham and celebrated by Homer is still renewed in the camps of the Arabs. The ferocious Bedouins, the terror of the desert, embrace without inquiry or hesitation the stranger who dares to confide in their honor and to enter their tent. His treatment is kind and respectful. He shares the wealth or the poverty of his host, and after a needful repose, he is dismissed on his way with thanks, with blessings, and perhaps with gifts. The heart and hand are more largely expanded by the wants of a brother or a friend. But the heroic acts that could deserve the public applause must have surpassed the narrow measure of discretion and experience. A dispute had arisen who, among the citizens of Mecca, was entitled to the prize of generosity, and a successive application was made to the three who were deemed most worthy of the trial. Abdallah, the son of Abbas, had undertaken a distant journey, and his foot was in the stirrup when he heard the voice of a suppliant. O son of the uncle of the apostle of God, I am a traveller and in distress. He instantly dismounted to present the pilgrim with his camel, a rich caparison, and a purse of 4,000 pieces of gold, excepting only the sword, either for its intrinsic value, or as the gift of an honored kinsman. The servant of Caius informed the second suppliant that his master was asleep, but he immediately added, "Here is a purse of 7,000 pieces of gold. It is all we have in the house, and here is an order that will entitle you to a camel and a slave." The master, as soon as he awoke, praised and enfranchised his faithful steward with a gentle reproof that by respecting his slumbers he had stinted his bounty. The third of these heroes, the blind Arabah, at the hour of prayer was supporting his steps on the shoulders of two slaves. "Alas," he replied, "my coffers are empty, but these you may sell. If you refuse, I renounce them." At these words, pushing away the youths, he groped along the wall with his staff. The character of Hatem is the perfect model of Arabian virtue. He was brave and liberal, an eloquent poet, and a successful robber. 40 camels were roasted at his hospitable feast, and at the prayer of a suppliant enemy, he restored both the captives and the spoil. The freedom of his countrymen disdained the laws of justice. They proudly indulged the spontaneous impulse of pity and benevolence. The religion of the Arabs, as well as of the Indians, consisted in the worship of the sun, the moon, and the fixed stars, a primitive and specious mode of superstition. The bright luminaries of the sky display the visible image of a deity. Their number and distance convey to a philosophic, or even a vulgar, eye the idea of boundless space. The character of eternity is marked on these solid globes that seem incapable of corruption or decay. The regularity of their motions may be ascribed to a principle of reason or instinct, and their zeal, more imaginary influence, encourages the vain belief that the earth and its inhabitants are the object of their peculiar care. The science of astronomy was cultivated at Babylon, but the school of the Arabs was a clear firmament and a naked plain. In their nocturnal marches they steered by the guidance of the stars. Their names and order and daily station were familiar to the curiosity and devotion of the Bedouin, and he was taught by experience to divide in 28 parts the zodiac of the moon, and to bless the constellations who refreshed with salutary rains the thirst of the desert. The reign of the heavenly orbs could not be extended beyond the visible sphere, and some metaphysical powers were necessary to sustain the transmigration of souls and the resurrection of bodies. A camel was left to perish on the grave, that he might serve his master in another life, and the invocation of departed spirits implies that they were still endowed with consciousness and power. I am ignorant, and I am careless, of the blind mythology of the barbarians, of the local deities, of the stars, the air, and the earth, of their sex or titles, their attributes or subordination. Each tribe, each family, each independent warrior created and changed the rites and the object of his fantastic worship. But the nation, in every age, has bowed to the religion as well as to the language of Mecca. The genuine antiquity of the Kaaba ascends beyond the Christian era. In describing the coast of the Red Sea, the Greek historian Diodorus has remarked between the Thamudites and the Sabaeans, a famous temple whose superior sanctity was revered by all the Arabians. The linen or silken veil, which is annually renewed by the Turkish emperor, was first offered by a pious king of the Homerites, who reigned 700 years before the time of Muhammad. A tent or a cavern might suffice for the worship of the savages, but an edifice of stone and clay has been erected in its place, and the art and power of the monarchs of the East have been confined to the simplicity of the original model. A spacious portico encloses the quadrangle of the Kaaba, a square chapel, 24 cubits long, 23 broad, and 27 high. A door and a window admit the light. The double roof is supported by three pillars of wood. A spout, now of gold, discharges the rainwater, and the well Zemzem is protected by a dome from accidental pollution. The tribe of Quraysh, by fraud and force, had acquired the custody of the Kaaba. The sacerdotal office devolved through four lineal descents to the grandfather of Muhammad, and the family of the Hashemites, from whence he sprung, was the most respectable and sacred in the eyes of their country. The precincts of Mecca enjoyed the rites of sanctuary, and in the last month of each year the city and the temple were crowded with a long train of pilgrims, who presented their vows and offerings in the house of God. The same rites which are now accomplished by the faithful Muslims were invented and practiced by the superstition of the idolaters. At an awful distance they cast away their garments. Seven times with hasty steps they encircled the Kaaba and kissed the black stone. Seven times they visited and adored the adjacent mountains. Seven times they threw stones into the valley of Mina, and the pilgrimage was achieved, as at the present hour, by sacrifice of sheep and camels, and the burial of their hair and nails in the consecrated ground. Each tribe either found or introduced in the Kaaba their domestic worship. The temple was adorned, or defiled, with 360 idols of men, eagles, lions, and antelopes, and most conspicuous was the statue of Hibal, of red agate, holding in his hand seven arrows, without heads or feathers, the instruments and symbols of profane divination. But this statue was a monument of Syrian arts. The devotion of the ruder ages was content with a pillar or a tablet, and the rocks of the desert were hewn into gods or altars in imitation of the black stone of Mecca, which is deeply tainted with the reproach of an idolatrous origin. From Japan to Peru, the use of sacrifice has universally prevailed, and the votary has expressed his gratitude or fear by destroying or consuming in honor of the gods the dearest and most precious of their gifts. The life of a man is the most precious oblation to deprecate a public calamity. The altars of Phoenicia and Egypt, of Rome and Carthage, have been polluted with human gore. The cruel practice was long preserved among the Arabs. In the 3rd century, a boy was annually sacrificed by the tribe of the Dumatians, and a royal captive was piously slaughtered by the prince of the Saracens, the ally and soldier of the Emperor Justinian. A parent who drags his son to the altar exhibits the most painful and sublime effort of fanaticism. The deed, or the intention, was sanctified by the example of saints and heroes, and the father of Muhammad himself was devoted by a rash vow, and hardly ransomed for the equivalent of 100 camels. In the time of ignorance, the Arabs, like the Jews and Egyptians, abstained from the taste of swine's flesh. They circumcised their children at the age of puberty. The same customs, without the censure or the precept of the Quran, have been silently transmitted to their posterity and proselytes. It has been sagaciously conjectured that the artful legislator indulged the stubborn prejudices of his countrymen. It is more simple to believe that he adhered to the habits and opinions of his youth without foreseeing that a practice congenial to the climate of Mecca might become useless or inconvenient on the banks of the Danube or the Volga. Arabia was free. The adjacent kingdoms were shaken by the storms of conquest and tyranny, and the persecuted sects fled to the happy land where they might profess what they thought and practice what they professed. The religions of the Sabians and Magians, of the Jews and Christians, were disseminated from the Persian Gulf to the Red Sea. In a remote period of antiquity, Sabianism was diffused over Asia by the science of the Chaldeans and the arms of the Assyrians. From the observations of 2,000 years, the priests and astronomers of Babylon deduced the eternal laws of nature and providence. They adored the 7 gods or angels who directed the course of the 7 planets and shed their irresistible influence on the earth. The attributes of the 7 planets, with the 12 signs of the zodiac and the 24 constellations of the northern and southern hemisphere, were represented by images and talismans. The 7 days of the week were dedicated to their respective deities. The Sabians prayed thrice each day, and the temple of the moon at Haran was the term of their pilgrimage. But the flexible genius of their faith was always ready either to teach or to learn. In the tradition of the creation, the deluge, and the patriarchs, they held a singular agreement with their Jewish captives. They appealed to the secret books of Adam, Seth, and Enoch, and a slight infusion of the gospel has transformed the last remnant of the polytheists into the Christians of St. John in the territory of Bassora. The altars of Babylon were overturned by the Magians, but the injuries of the Sabians were revenged by the sword of Alexander. Persia groaned above 500 years under a foreign yoke, and the purest disciples of Zoroaster escaped from the contagion of idolatry and breathed with their adversaries the freedom of the desert. 700 years before the death of Muhammad, the Jews were settled in Arabia, and a far greater multitude was expelled from the Holy Land in the wars of Titus and Hadrian. The industrious exiles aspired to liberty and power. They erected synagogues in the cities and castles in the wilderness, and their Gentile converts were confounded with the children of Israel, whom they resembled in the outward mark of circumcision. The Christian missionaries were still more active and successful. The Catholics asserted their universal reign. The sects whom they oppressed successively retired beyond the limits of the Roman Empire. The Marcionites and Manichaeans dispersed their fantastic opinions and apocryphal gospels. The churches of Yemen and the princes of Hira and Ghassan were instructed in a purer creed by the Jacobite and Nestorian bishops. The liberty of choice was presented to the tribes. Each Arab was free to elect or to compose his private religion, and the rude superstition of his house was mingled with the sublime theology of saints and philosophers. A fundamental article of faith was inculcated by the consent of the learned strangers, the existence of one supreme God who is exalted above the powers of heaven and earth, but who has often revealed himself to mankind by the ministry of his angels and prophets, and whose grace or justice has interpreted, by seasonable miracles, the order of nature. The most rational of the Arabs acknowledged his power, though they neglected his worship, and it was habit rather than conviction that still attached them to the relics of idolatry. The Jews and Christians were the people of the book. The Bible was already translated into the Arabic language, and the volume of the Old Testament was accepted by the concord of these implacable enemies. In the story of the Hebrew patriarchs, the Arabs were pleased to discover the fathers of their nation. They applauded the birth and promises of Ismail, revered the faith and virtue of Abraham, traced his pedigree and their own to the creation of the first man, and imbibed with equal credulity the prodigies of the holy text and the dreams and traditions of the Jewish rabbis. The base and plebeian origin of Muhammad is an unskillful calumny of the Christians, who exalt instead of degrading the merit of their adversary. His descent from Ismail was a national privilege or fable, but if the first steps of the pedigree are dark and doubtful, he could produce many generations of pure and genuine nobility. He sprung from the tribe of Quraysh and the family of Hashem, the most illustrious of the Arabs, the princes of Mecca, and the hereditary guardians of the Kaaba. The grandfather of Muhammad was Abdul Muttalib, the son of Hashem, a wealthy and generous citizen who relieved the distress of famine with the supplies of commerce. Mecca, which had been fed by the liberality of the father, was saved by the courage of the son. The kingdom of Yemen was subject to the Christian princes of Abyssinia. Their vassal, Abrahah, was provoked by an insult to avenge the honor of the cross, and the holy city was invested by a train of elephants and an army of Africans. A treaty was proposed, and in the first audience, the grandfather of Muhammad demanded the restitution of his cattle. "And why," said Abrahah, "do you not rather implore my clemency in favor of your temple, which I have threatened to destroy?" "Because," replied the intrepid chief, "the cattle is my own. The Kaaba belongs to the gods, and they will defend their house from injury and sacrilege." The want of provisions, or the valor of the Quraysh, compelled the Abyssinians to a disgraceful retreat. Their discomfiture has been adorned with a miraculous flight of birds, who showered down stones on the heads of the infidels, and the deliverance was long commemorated by the era of the elephant. The glory of Abdul Muttalib was crowned with domestic happiness. His life was prolonged to the age of 110 years, and he became the father of 6 daughters and 13 sons. His best-beloved Abdallah was the most beautiful and modest of the Arabian youth, and in the first night when he consummated his marriage with Amina of the noble race of the Zarites, 200 virgins are said to have expired of jealousy and despair. Muhammad, or more properly Muhammad, the only son of Abdallah and Amina, was born at Mecca, 4 years after the death of Justinian, and 2 months after the defeat of the Abyssinians. Mahomet, or more properly Muhammad, the only son of Abdallah and Amina, was born at Mecca 4 years after the death of Justinian, and 2 months after the defeat of the Abyssinians, whose victory would have introduced into the Kaaba the religion of the Christians. In his early infancy he was deprived of his father, his mother, and his grandfather. His uncles were strong and numerous, and in the division of the inheritance the orphan's share was reduced to 5 camels and an Ethiopian maidservant. At home and abroad, in peace and war, Abu Talib, the most respectable of his uncles, was the guide and guardian of his youth. In his 25th year, he entered into the service of Khadija, a rich and noble widow of Mecca, who soon rewarded his fidelity with the gift of her hand and fortune. The marriage contract, in the simple style of antiquity, recites the mutual love of Muhammad and Khadija, describes him as the most accomplished of the tribe of Quraysh, and stipulates a dowry of 12 ounces of gold and 20 camels, which was supplied by the liberality of his uncle. By this alliance the son of Abdallah was restored to the station of his ancestors, and the judicious matron was content with his domestic virtues, till in the 40th year of his age he assumed the title of a prophet, and proclaimed the religion of the Qur'an. According to the tradition of his companions, Muhammad was distinguished by the beauty of his person, an outward gift which is seldom despised, except by those to whom it has been refused. Before he spoke, the orator engaged on his side the affections of a public or private audience. They applauded his commanding presence, his majestic aspect, his piercing eye, his gracious smile, his flowing beard, his countenance that painted every sensation of the soul, and his gestures that enforced each expression of the tongue. In the familiar offices of life, he scrupulously adhered to the grave and ceremonious politeness of his country. His respectful attention to the rich and powerful was dignified by his condescension and affability to the poorest citizens of Mecca. The frankness of his manner concealed the artifice of his views, and the habits of courtesy were imputed to personal friendship or universal benevolence. His memory was capacious and retentive, his wit easy and social, his imagination sublime, his judgment clear, rapid, and decisive. He possessed the courage both of thought and action, and although his designs might gradually expand with his success, the first idea which he entertained of his divine mission bears the stamp of an original and superior genius. The son of Abdallah was educated in the bosom of the noblest race, in the use of the purest dialect of Arabia, and the fluency of his speech was corrected and enhanced by the practice of discreet and seasonable silence. With these powers of eloquence, Muhammad was an illiterate barbarian. His youth had never been instructed in the arts of reading and writing. The common ignorance exempted him from shame or reproach, but he was reduced to a narrow circle of existence, and deprived of those faithful mirrors which reflect to our mind the minds of sages and heroes. Yet the book of nature and of man was open to his view, and some fancy has been indulged in the political and philosophical observations which are ascribed to the Arabian traveller. He compares the nations and the regions of the earth, discovers the weakness of the Persian and Roman monarchies, builds with pity and indignation the degeneracy of the times, and resolves to unite under one God and one King the invincible spirit and primitive virtues of the Arabs. Our more accurate inquiry will suggest that instead of visiting the courts, the camps, the temples of the East, the two journeys of Muhammad into Syria were confined to the fairs of Bostra and Damascus, that he was only 13 years of age when he accompanied the caravan of his uncle, and that his duty compelled him to return as soon as he had disposed of the merchandise of Khadija. In these hasty and superficial excursions, the eye of genius might discern some objects invisible to his grosser companions. Some seeds of knowledge might be cast upon a fruitful soil. But his ignorance of the Syriac language must have checked his curiosity, and I cannot perceive in the life or writings of Muhammad that his prospect was far extended beyond the limits of the Arabian world. From every region of that solitary world, the pilgrims of Mecca were annually assembled by the calls of devotion and commerce. In the free concourse of multitudes, a simple citizen in his native tongue might study the political state and character of the tribes, the theory and practice of the Jews and Christians. Some useful strangers might be tempted or forced to implore the rights of hospitality, And the enemies of Muhammad have named the Jew, the Persian, and the Syrian monk, whom they accuse of lending their secret aid to the composition of the Quran. Conversation enriches the understanding, but solitude is the school of genius, and the uniformity of a work denotes the hand of a single artist. From his earliest youth, Muhammad was addicted to religious contemplation. Each year, during the month of Ramadan, he withdrew from the world and from the arms of Khadija. In the cave of Hira, 3 miles from Mecca, he consulted the spirit of fraud or enthusiasm, whose abode is not in the heavens, but in the mind of the Prophet. The faith, which, under the name of Islam, he preached to his family and nation, is compounded of an eternal truth and a necessary fiction, that there is only one God, and that Muhammad is the apostle of God. It is the boast of the Jewish apologists that while the learned nations of antiquity were deluded by the fables of polytheism, their simple ancestors of Palestine preserved the knowledge and worship of the true God. The moral attributes of Jehovah may not easily be reconciled with the standard of human virtue. His metaphysical qualities are darkly expressed, but each page of the Pentateuch and the prophets is an evidence of his power. The unity of his name is inscribed on the first table of the law, and his sanctuary was never defiled by any visible image of the invisible essence. After the ruin of the temple, the faith of the Hebrew exiles was purified, fixed, and enlightened by the spiritual devotion of the synagogue. And the authority of Muhammad will not justify his perpetual reproach that the Jews of Mecca or Medina adored Ezra as the Son of God. But the children of Israel had ceased to be a people, and the religions of the world were guilty, at least in the eyes of the Prophet, of giving sons or daughters or companions to the supreme God. In the rude idolatry of the Arabs, the crime is manifest and audacious. The Sabians are poorly excused by the preeminence of the first planet, or intelligence, in their celestial hierarchy. In the Magian system, the conflict of the two principles betrays the imperfection of the conqueror. The Christians of the 7th century had insensibly relapsed into a semblance of paganism. Their public and private vows were addressed to the relics and images that disgraced the temples of the East. The throne of the Almighty was darkened by a cloud of martyrs and saints and angels, the objects of popular veneration, and the Coloridian heretics, who flourished in the fruitful soil of Arabia, invested the Virgin Mary with the name and honors of a goddess. The mysteries of the Trinity and Incarnation appear to contradict the principle of the divine unity. In their obvious sense, they introduce 3 equal deities, and transform the man Jesus into the substance of the Son of God. An orthodox commentary will satisfy only a believing mind. Intemperate curiosity and zeal had torn the veil of the sanctuary, and each of the Oriental sects was eager to confess that all, except themselves, deserved the reproach of idolatry and polytheism. The creed of Muhammad is free from suspicion or ambiguity, and the Quran is a glorious testimony to the unity of God. The Prophet of Mecca rejected the worship of idols and men, of stars and planets, on the rational principle that whatever rises must set, that whatever is born must die, that whatever is corruptible must decay and perish. And the author of the universe, his rational enthusiasm, confessed and adored an infinite and eternal being, without form or place, without issue or similitude, present to our most secret thoughts, existing by the necessity of his own nature, and deriving from himself all moral and intellectual perfection. These sublime truths, thus announced in the language of the Prophet, are firmly held by his disciples, and defined with metaphysical precision by the interpreters of the Quran. A philosophic theist might subscribe the popular creed of the Mohammedans, a creed too sublime perhaps for our present faculties. What object remains for the fancy or even the understanding when we have abstracted from the unknown substance all ideas of time and space, of motion and matter, of sensation and reflection? The first principle of reason and revolution was confirmed by the voice of Muhammad. His proselytes, from India to Morocco, are distinguished by the name of Unitarians, and the danger of idolatry has been prevented by the interdiction of images. The doctrine of eternal decrees and absolute predestination is strictly embraced by the Mohammedans, and they struggle with the common difficulties how to reconcile the prescience of God with the freedom and responsibility of man, how to explain the permission of evil under the reign of infinite power and infinite goodness. The God of nature has written his existence on all his works, and his law in the heart of man. To restore the knowledge of the one and the practice of the other has been the real or pretended aim of the prophets of every age. The liberality of Muhammad allowed to his predecessors the same credit which he claimed for himself, and the chain of inspiration was prolonged from the fall of Adam to the promulgation of the Quran. During that period, some rays of prophetic light had been imparted to 124,000 of the elect, discriminated by their respective measure of virtue and grace. 313 apostles were sent with a special commission to recall their country from idolatry and vice. 104 volumes have been dictated by the Holy Spirit, and 6 legislators of transcendent brightness have announced to mankind the 6 successive revelations of various rites, but of one immutable religion. The authority and station of Adam, Noah, Abraham, Moses, Christ, and Muhammad rise in just gradation above each other. But whatsoever hates or rejects any one of the prophets is numbered with the infidels. The writings of the patriarchs were extant only in the apocryphal copies of the Greeks and Syrians. The conduct of Adam had not entitled him to the gratitude or respect of his children. The 7 precepts of Noah were observed by an inferior and imperfect class of the proselytes of the synagogue. And the memory of Abraham was obscurely revered by the Sabians in his native land of Chaldea. Of the myriads of prophets, Moses and Christ alone lived and reigned. And the remnant of the inspired writings was comprised in the books of the Old and the New Testament. The miraculous story of Moses is consecrated and embellished in the Quran, and the captive Jews enjoy the secret revenge of imposing their own belief on the nations whose recent creeds they deride. For the author of Christianity, the Mohammedans are taught by the prophet to entertain a high and mysterious reverence. Verily, Christ Jesus, the Son of Mary, is the apostle of God, and his word which he conveyed unto Mary, and a spirit proceeding from him, honorable in this world and in the world to come, and one of those who approach near to the presence of God. The wonders of the genuine and apocryphal Gospels are profusely heaped on his head, and the Latin Church has not disdained to borrow from the Quran the immaculate conception of his Virgin Mother. Yet Jesus was a mere mortal, and at the day of judgment his testimony will serve to condemn both the Jews who reject him as a prophet and the Christians who adore him as the Son of God. The malice of his enemies aspersed his reputation and conspired against his life, but their intention only was guilty. A phantom or a criminal was substituted on the cross, and the innocent saint was translated to the 7th heaven. During 600 years, the gospel was the way of truth and salvation. But the Christians insensibly forgot both the laws and example of their founder, and Mohammed was instructed by the Gnostics to accuse the church as well as the synagogue of corrupting the integrity of the sacred text. The piety of Moses and of Christ rejoiced in the assurance of a future prophet more illustrious than themselves. The evangelical promise of the Paraclete, or Holy Ghost, was prefigured in the name and accomplished in the person of Muhammad, the greatest and the last of the apostles of God. The communication of ideas requires a similitude of thought and language. The discourse of a philosopher would vibrate without effect on the ear of a peasant. Yet how minute is the distance of their understandings if it be compared with the contact of an infinite and a finite mind, with the word of God expressed by the tongue or the pen of a mortal. The inspiration of the Hebrew prophets, of the apostles and evangelists of Christ, might not be incompatible with the exercise of their reason and memory, and the diversity of their genius is strongly marked in the style and composition of the books of the Old and New Testament. But Muhammad was content with a character, more humble yet more sublime, of a simpler editor. The substance of the Quran, according to himself or his disciples, is uncreated and eternal, subsisting in the essence of the deity, and inscribed with a pen of light on the table of his everlasting decrees. A paper copy in a volume of silk and gems was brought down to the lowest heaven by the angel Gabriel, who, under the Jewish economy, had indeed been dispatched on the most important errands. And this trusty messenger successively revealed the chapters and verses to the Arabian prophet. Instead of a perpetual and perfect measure of the divine will, the fragments of the Quran were produced at the discretion of Muhammad. Each revelation is suited to the emergencies of his policy or passion, and all contradiction is removed by the saving maxim that any text of Scripture is abrogated or modified by any subsequent passage. The word of God and of the apostle was diligently recorded by his disciples on palm leaves and the shoulder bones of mutton, and the pages, without order or connection, were cast into a domestic chest in the custody of one of his wives. 2 years after the death of Muhammad, the sacred volume was collected and published by his friend and successor, Abu Bakr. The work was revised by the Caliph Uthman in the 30th year of the Hegira, and the various editions of the Quran assert the same miraculous privilege of a uniform and incorruptible text. In the spirit of enthusiasm or vanity, the prophet rests the truth of his mission on the merit of his book, audaciously challenges both men and angels to imitate the beauties of a single page, and presumes to assert that God alone could dictate this incomparable performance. This argument is most powerfully addressed to a devout Arabian whose mind is attuned to faith and rapture, whose ear is delighted by the music of sounds, and whose ignorance is incapable of comparing the productions of human genius. The harmony and copiousness of style will not reach, in a version, the European infidel. He will peruse with impatience the endless, incoherent rhapsody of fable and precept and declamation, which seldom excites a sentiment or an idea, which sometimes crawls in the dust and is sometimes lost in the clouds. The divine attributes exalt the fancy of the Arabian missionary, but his loftiest strains must yield to the sublime simplicity of the Book of Job, composed in a remote age, in the same country, and in the same language. If the composition of the Quran exceed the faculties of a man, to what superior intelligence should we ascribe the Iliad of Homer, or the Philippics of Demosthenes? In all religions, the life of the founder supplies the silence of his written revelation. The sayings of Muhammad were so many lessons of truth, his actions so many examples of virtue, and the public and private memorials were preserved by his wives and companions. At the end of 200 years, the Sunnah, or oral law, was fixed and consecrated by the labors of Al-Bukhari, who discriminated 7,275 genuine traditions from a mass of 300,000 reports of a more doubtful or spurious character. Each day the pious author prayed in the temple of Mecca and performed his ablutions with the water of Zemzem. The pages were successively deposited on the pulpit and the sepulchre of the apostle, and the work has been approved by the 4 orthodox sects of the Sunnites. The mission of the ancient prophets, of Moses and of Jesus, had been confirmed by many splendid prodigies, and Muhammad was repeatedly urged by the inhabitants of Mecca and Medina to produce a similar evidence of his divine legation, to call down from heaven the angel or the volume of his revelation, to create a garden in the desert or to kindle a conflagration in the unbelieving city. As often as he is pressed by the demands of the Quraysh, he involves himself in the obscure boast of vision and prophecy, appeals to the internal proofs of his doctrine, and shields himself behind the providence of God, who refuses those signs and wonders that would depreciate the merit of faith and aggravate the guilt of infidelity. But the modest or angry tone of his apologies betrays his weakness and vexation, and these passages of scandal established beyond suspicion the integrity of the Quran. The votaries of Muhammad are more assured than himself of his miraculous gifts, and their confidence and credulity increase as they are farther removed from the time and place of his spiritual exploits. They believe or affirm that trees went forth to meet him, that he was saluted by stones, that water gushed from his fingers, that he fed the hungry, cured the sick, and raised the dead, that a beam groaned to him, that a camel complained to him, that a shoulder of mutton informed him of its being poisoned, and that both animate and inanimate nature were equally subject to the apostle of God. His dream of a nocturnal journey is seriously described as a real and corporeal transaction. A mysterious animal, the Borak, conveyed him from the temple of Mecca to that of Jerusalem. With his companion Gabriel, he successively ascended the 7 heavens and received and repaid the salutations of the patriarchs, the prophets, and the angels in their respective mansions. Beyond the 7th heaven, Muhammad alone was permitted to proceed. He passed the veil of unity, approached within 2 bowshots of the throne, and felt a cold that pierced him to the heart when his shoulder was touched by the hand of God. After this familiar, though important, conversation, he again descended to Jerusalem, remounted the Borak, returned to Mecca, and performed in the 10th part of a night the journey of many 1,000 years. According to another legend, the apostle confounded in a national assembly the malicious challenge of the Quraysh. His resistless words split asunder the orb of the moon. The obedient planet stooped from her station in the sky, accomplished the 7 revolutions round the Kaaba, saluted Muhammad in the Arabian tongue, and suddenly contracting her dimensions, entered at the collar and issued forth through the sleeve of his shirt. The vulgar are amused with these marvelous tales, but the gravest of the Muslim doctors imitate the modesty of their master and indulge a latitude of faith or interpretation. They might speciously allege that in preaching the religion, it was needless to violate the harmony of nature, that a creed unclouded with mystery may be excused from miracles, and that the sword of Muhammad was not less potent than the rod of Moses. The polytheist is oppressed and distracted by the variety of superstition. A thousand rites of Egyptian origin were interwoven with the essence of the Mosaic law, and the spirit of the gospel had evaporated in the pageantry of the church. The prophet of Mecca was tempted by prejudice or policy or patriotism to sanctify the rites of the Arabians and the custom of visiting the holy stone of the Kaaba. But the precepts of Muhammad himself inculcates a more simple and rational piety. Prayer, fasting, and alms are the religious duties of a Muslim, and he is encouraged to hope that prayer will carry him halfway to God, fasting will bring him to the door of his palace, and alms will gain him admittance. According to the tradition of the nocturnal journey, the apostle, in his personal conference with the deity, was commanded to impose on his disciples the daily obligation of 50 prayers. By the advice of Moses, he applied for an alleviation of this intolerable burden. The number was gradually reduced to 5, without any dispensation of business or pleasure, or time or place. The devotion of the faithful is repeated at daybreak, at noon, in the afternoon, in the evening, and at the first watch of the night. And in the present decay of religious fervor, our travelers are edified by the profound humility and attention of the Turks and Persians. Cleanliness is the key of prayer. The frequent lustration of the hands, the face, and the body, which was practiced of old by the Arabs, is solemnly enjoined by the Quran, and a permission is formally granted to supply with sand the scarcity of water. The words and attitudes of supplication, as it is performed either sitting or standing or prostrate on the ground, are prescribed by custom or authority. But the prayer is poured forth in short and fervent ejaculations. The measure of zeal is not exhausted by a tedious liturgy, and each Muslim for his own person is invested with the character of a priest. Among the theists who reject the use of images, it has been found necessary to restrain the wanderings of the fancy by directing the eye and the thought towards a qibla, or visible point of the horizon. The prophet was at first inclined to gratify the Jews by the choice of Jerusalem, but he soon returned to a more natural partiality. And 5 times every day the eyes of the nations at Astrakhan, at Fez, at Delhi, are devoutly turned to the holy temple of Mecca. Yet every spot for the service of God is equally pure. The Mohammedans indifferently pray in their chamber or in the street. As a distinction from the Jews and Christians, the Friday in each week is set apart for the useful institution of public worship. The people is assembled in the mosque, and the imam, some respectable elder, ascends the pulpit to begin the prayer and pronounce the sermon. But the Mohammedan religion is destitute of priesthood or sacrifice, and the independent spirit of fanaticism looks down with contempt on the ministers and the slaves of superstition. The voluntary penance of the ascetics, the torment and glory of their lives, was odious to a prophet who censured in his companions a rash vow of abstaining from flesh and women and sleep, and firmly declared that he would suffer no monks in his religion. Yet he instituted in each year a fast of 30 days, and strenuously recommended the observance as a discipline which purifies the soul and subdues the body, as a salutary exercise of obedience to the will of God and his apostle. During the month of Ramadan, from the rising to the setting of the sun, the Muslim abstains from eating and drinking and women and baths and perfumes. From all nourishment that can restore his strength, from all pleasure that can gratify his senses. In the revolution of the lunar year, the Ramadan coincides, by turns, with the winter cold and the summer heat, and the patient martyr, without assuaging his thirst with a drop of water, must expect the close of a tedious and sultry day. The interdiction of wine, peculiar to some orders of priests or hermits, is converted by Muhammad alone into a positive and general law, and a considerable portion of the globe has abjured at his command the use of that salutary though dangerous liquor. These painful restraints are doubtless infringed by the libertine and eluded by the hypocrite. But the legislator by whom they are enacted cannot surely be accused of alluring his proselytes by the indulgence of their sensual appetites. The charity of the Mohammedans descends to the animal creation, and the Quran repeatedly inculcates, not as a merit, but as a strict and indispensable duty, the relief of the indigent and unfortunate. Muhammad, perhaps, is the only lawgiver who has defined the precise measure of charity. The standard may vary with the degree and nature of property, as it consists either in money, in corn or cattle, in fruits or merchandise. But the Muslim does not accomplish the law unless he bestows a tenth of his revenue. And if his conscience accuses him of fraud or extortion, the tenth, under the idea of restitution, is enlarged to a fifth. Benevolence is the foundation of justice, since we are forbidden to injure those whom we are bound to assist. A prophet may reveal the secrets of heaven and of futurity, but in his moral precepts he can only repeat the lessons of our own hearts. The two articles of belief and the four practical duties of Islam are guarded by rewards and punishments, and the faith of the Muslim is devoutly fixed on the event of the judgment and the last day. The Prophet has not presumed to determine the moment of that awful catastrophe, though he darkly announces the signs, both in heaven and earth, which will precede the universal dissolution, when life shall be destroyed, and the order of creation shall be confounded in the primitive chaos. At the blast of the trumpet, new worlds will start into being. Angels, genie, and men will arise from the dead, and the human soul will again be united to the body. The doctrine of the resurrection was first entertained by the Egyptians, and their mummies were embalmed, their pyramids were constructed to preserve the ancient mansion of the soul during a period of 3,000 years. But the attempt is partial and unavailing, and it is with a more philosophic spirit that Muhammad relies on the omnipotence of the Creator, whose word can reanimate the breathless clay and collect the innumerable atoms that no longer retain their form or substance. The intermediate state of the soul, it is hard to decide, and those who most firmly believe her immaterial nature are at a loss to understand how she can think or act without the agency of the organs of sense. The reunion of the soul and body will be followed by the final judgment of mankind, and in his copy of the Magian picture, the prophet has too faithfully represented the forms of proceeding, and even the slow and successive operations of an earthly tribunal. By his intolerant adversaries, he is upbraided for extending, even to themselves, the hope of salvation, or asserting the blackest heresy, that every man who believes in God and accomplishes good works may expect in the last day a favorable sentence. Such rational indifference is ill-adapted to the character of a fanatic, nor is it probable that a messenger from heaven